Before the next talk, the last talk of this morning plenary session, so Frank Sauressing will tell us about black holes in asymptotically safe gravity.
So let me start by thanking the organizers for the opportunity to talk on this work. And the idea is to move a little bit away from loop quantum gravity now and tell you what other approaches of quantum gravity, namely asymptotic safety, have to say about black holes. So the structure of the talk will be as follows. So there are two chapters that will be rather introductory. So first, there's the motivation, why we want to study black holes. And then I will make a nutshell presentation what we mean by asymptotic safety. The second part concerns the tools that we use to learn about black holes and the summary of results that have been compiled so far. And given the time, I will then take a little detour and tell you about the connection between Horava-Lifschitz, CDT, and asymptotic safety. So let's get started and see why black holes are interesting objects to study. So number one is they are really observed in nature. So here we have the line element of a Schwarzschild black hole. It's a vacuum solution of Einstein's equations. It's the simplest one. And what you see here on the right-hand side is actually a snapshot of the center of our Milky Way. So this has been assembled over 20 years, and people have tracked orbits of stars orbiting the center of the Milky Way. And down here in the center, you see there has to be a big mass where these stars orbit around. The mass of the sky has been measured to be of the order of a million solar masses. And given the size of this picture, the only object that is massive enough to cause this gravitational force on the stars has to be a black hole. So this is firsthand evidence that these guys really exist in nature. From the theoretical side, we have already heard this morning, there are a lot of interesting phenomena related with black holes. So first, we have talked about uniqueness theorems. So interestingly, no matter how the black hole is formed, the final state of the black hole collapse is actually described by a small number of parameters. Here we have the mass, angular momentum, and charges. So this goes by no-hair theorems for black holes. Then we have seen that there's a curvature singularity at the origin, classically, and often say people say that this is actually a hint that general relativity predicts its own breakdown. If we go to the line element that we had on the previous slide, then the Schwarzschild black hole has a black hole horizon where the metric degenerates. So this is sitting here, it depends on the mass. And if we study the black hole solutions on a semi-classical limit, we have heard that there's a temperature associated with this horizon. This is the Hawking temperature given here. And one can also associate an entropy to the horizon, which is proportional to the horizon area. Given these two quantities, we have heard essential questions that are related with these two things. So essentially, we want to know what is the origin of this entropy factor. There's one more interesting Gedanken experiment that you can do with black holes. This is related to the information loss problem. So given that you have two highly energetic particles, so two particles with Trans-Planckian energies, you can think about scattering them. And what will happen if they meet head-on is they will form a black hole. Then we know, semi-classically, the black hole will decay into Hawking radiation. So at that point, all the information that is contained here in the initial state is lost. So in order to address this question, you get into the realm of quantum gravity. So this gives you some motivation to look into this realm of physics. So this concludes the first part of the introduction. So let's have a look at asymptotic safety as a candidate theory of quantum gravity here. So first slide is a reminder why we are sitting here. So why don't we have this theory of quantum gravity already? And this is the short summary. So we know that classically the theory has an action. It's the Einstein-Hilbert action. There are two coupling constants sitting here. So there's Newton constant and the cosmological constant. And the problem with quantizing this theory is actually in the mass dimension of Newton's constant. So in four dimensions, this guy has a negative mass dimension. And this causes all kinds of troubles if you want to carry out a perturbative quantization program based on this action. So here is this problem phrased in modern Wilsonian language. So Wilson understood that if we want to renormalize a theory, then this renormalization properties are actually associated with fixed points of the renormalization group flow. And if a theory is perturbatively renormalizable, that means that the associated fixed point is the Gaussian fixed point. So then you can do the following steps. You can take the coupling constants up here, introduce an appropriate renormalization group scale K to define dimensionless couplings, and compute the beta functions of the running couplings. So here the order G, these are quantum effects. And you see that the leading coefficients are actually given by the mass dimension. The problem is that this leading coefficient for Newton's constant is actually positive. That means if you integrate these RG trajectories, the trajectory will not approach the Gaussian fixed point, but go away. So this is a statement which is well known to this audience here, namely that general relativity is perturbatively non-randomizable. Then asymptotic safety, what is this? It is the attempt to still make sense of gravity in the framework of quantum field theory. And the central idea that had been formulated by Weinberg is that the UV completion of the theory is not provided by the Gaussian fixed point, which we are used to from perturbation theory, but we have a different kind of fixed point, a non-trivial or non-Gaussian fixed point. The idea is that this fixed point actually controls the UV behavior of our theory. So this is good enough to ensure that scattering amplitudes will not develop unphysical divergences. Then the second requirement of this program to work is we want to be the theory to be predictive. And this is related to the number of relevant deformations you can do on this fixed point. So in principle, you could think about this fixed point as a conformal field theory. And then you study relevant operators to deform this theory. And these operators actually form this UV critical surface. In order to be predictive, you then require that you only have a finite number of these relevant perturbations. What you then do is you have to do experiments to determine your relevant parameters, and that tells you how the RG trajectory realized in nature is actually situated in the surface. So this concerns the UV part of the theory. Then you also need to know something about the infrared. So here we know that classical general relativity gives a good description of gravity. So we insist that our RG flow goes to a region where general relativity is actually a good approximation. And by enforcing this condition, we can then recover all the successes of general relativity and reproduce data on perihelion shifts, gravitational lensing, nuclear synthesis, and many more tests. Then you can bunch this package together, and this makes the theory going by asymptotic safety gravity, or it has been named quantum Einstein gravity. Now it's the question, this is the program, how far have we gotten into realizing this program and checking these conditions A, B, C? And here's the sample plot of one of the first computations that has been done in this realm. So this is 10 years ago. Here you see the dimensionless Newton's constant on this axis. The dimensionless cosmological constant is on this axis. Here in the center, you see the Gaussian fixed point that played the role in the perturbative quantization. And up here, there is a non-Gaussian fixed point. Now the arrows go from UV to infrared. So if you start with a theory that resembles general relativity, so that's it down here, and you trace the RG flow upwards through the UV, you see that the RG trajectories don't end up in this Gaussian fixed point, but they are attracted to this non-Gaussian fixed point. So this gives you some idea that this scenario actually could work. Then it's the question, on which of these RG trajectories on the previous graph are we actually living? And at this level of the computation, that means you have to do a measurement, namely you have to measure Newton's constant and the cosmological constant. And this can only be done in a regime where classical general relativity works. So this is down here. And what is important to realize is that the smallness of the cosmological constant selects a very particular RG trajectory. So the thing that we are sitting on is actually highly fine-tuned in the sense that you get very close to the Gaussian fixed point. So only in the very last moment, you turn away and flow up to the non-Gaussian fixed point. And essentially, this fine-tuning also ensures that classical general relativity is a good theory over many, many orders of magnitude. So here, you really observe classical physics as we know. This picture has recently been extended, so we wanted to see how much holds if we include the running of higher derivative terms in the picture. So now you have the running of cosmological constant, Newton's constant, and an additional parameter associated with an R squared term. And you actually see in this picture that the essential picture remains robust. You still have the non-Gaussian fixed point for the UV completion. And starting from this picture, fixed point, you cross over to the Gaussian fixed point in the infrared. So this ensures that down here you still have good regimes where classical general relativity is valid. Then you can wonder what happens in the deep infrared, and I think there will be more talks concerning this feature in the afternoon parallel sessions. There's been much more in exploring actually the theory space of gravity in these RG flows. So this is the chart where we have computed and verified the existence of the non-Gaussian fixed point. So here we have included higher derivative scalar curvatures, and there was also some work including higher derivative tensor structures. The important lessons that we learned from these computations can be summarized in these three points. So all the computations that have been done so far confirmed that this non-Gaussian fixed point actually exists. We studied deformations around this fixed point, and we found that there is a low number of relevant parameters. So the most sophisticated computations say it's actually three. And then we also showed that counter terms that appear in the perturbative quantization of the theory do not affect the existence of this fixed point. Yes, sure.
So are you saying that in ordinary Einstein-Hilbert relativity, there exists this other fixed point?
The fixed point position is not the Einstein-Hilbert action. It gets some additional components and higher derivative terms, but yes, there is a fixed point on the space.
Okay.
So, given this theoretical side, we were wondering, what can we learn about black holes given this setup? So the tool that we have used to do this computation actually is called the effective average action. So the idea is we build our approach on the gravitational path integral, but instead of doing the path integral all at once, we integrate our quantum fluctuations shell by shell in momentum space. So you can picture this RG flows. You have initial conditions in the UV. Here you impose a classical action. And then you start integrating out quantum fluctuations. And once you have integrated out all your quantum fluctuations, you arrive at the ordinary effective action that we know. And in the intermediate regions, you have this object gamma k, which interpolates between your initial action at high energies and the effective actions at low energies. There are two important things about this object. First, we have an equation that actually governs the scale dependence of this gamma k. So this is given here. It's a Wetterich-type functional randomization group equation. So on the left-hand side, you see this is the change of gamma k with respect to the RG scale. And on the right-hand side, you have something that actually resembles a one-loop structure. So this trace is a typical one-loop integration. But what makes this equation actually exact is that here you don't have the variation of the bare action, but the fully traced propagators. Then we have this cutoff term RK. So this localizes the contribution here on the right-hand side in momentum space. So essentially, the right-hand side is peaked around fluctuations around K. The second important property that comes into game when you actually want to extract physics information from this gamma K is that you can look at vertices derived from this gamma k, and these are effective vertices. So these guys incorporate all the quantum corrections of fluctuations between p squared and this k squared. So in this sense, this gamma k provides an effective description for the physics up to momentum scale k squared. So we want to build a physical picture on this to this effective average action. And the idea is we make a transition from the classical GR to quantum space-time by essentially placing our computation not on the standard Einstein-Hilbert action, but we want to study the physics of, coming from our quantum theory. And in principle, what we would like to compute are observables. So do the path integral compute the vacuum expectation value of an object? I think I don't have to remind you that this is a very hard problem, especially given that we don't know what good observables in quantum gravity are. So an idea to bypass this problem has actually been advocated by Alfio Bonanno and Martin Reuter, is to extract the physics from a so-called RG improvement scheme. So instead of working with the classical action, we start with this object gamma k. And we want to exploit the information of the running couplings contained in this guy in order to get some idea what the quantum physics should look like. So in detail, this procedure is in step one, we replace the classical action by the effective average action, gamma k. Then we have a one-parameter family of effective actions which describe our physics. And then the second step consists in replacing this a priori unphysical cutoff k by a physical quantity that provides the infrared cutoff in our system. So at this stage, there's no canonical description how you should choose this physical cutoff. So here you definitely need some physical intuition about your system, what this guy could be. By performing this identification of K with a physical scale, you then get a modification of the classical system, which hopefully incorporates quantum effects. There have been several of these RG improvement schemes on the market. So the idea number one is you compute classical solutions of your classical equations, and at that level you promote your coupling constants to be scale dependent, and then you replace this scale dependence by the physical cutoff identification. So this is the scheme that goes by the name of improved classical solutions. Then you, with more sophistication, you can play this game at the level of equations of motion. So you derive classical equations of motion. And before solving the system, you do the replacement coupling constant goes to this running coupling constants with the cutoff identification. Even more sophisticated, you could do this directly at the level of the action. So what this entails is that instead of a standard Einstein-Hilbert action, you get some action that is of F of R type. Concerning the picture of black holes, I will focus on this first part, but in our work we also verified that the scheme 2 and 3 lead to identical results. So let's go into the realm of black holes and see what we can learn by applying these RG improvement techniques. There is one argument which actually motivated us to go in this research, and this is a cool argument because everybody knows what I've presented in the first half of the talk must be wrong. What's the reason behind that? And the reason is, well, essentially we say that the UV behavior of our theory is governed by a conformal field theory. And that means that the state count, there's a relation between the states of your theory and the energy, and the relation is given by a certain coefficient. So this is the exponent of a CFT, this is d minus 1 over d. Now, the argument that was put forward is as follows. We know that once we look into gravity at high energies, the partition function will be governed by black holes. So then you can compute what the corresponding relation based on black holes is. So we have the entropy, which is proportional to the area of the horizon. We have the energy that is proportional to the radius of the horizon to the power d minus 3. And by substituting these two relations, you actually observe that the state count is actually different. So here the exponent is d minus 2 divided by d minus 3. So then you observe that this guy is not equal to this guy. So the UV behavior cannot be described by a CFT unless there's a caveat these authors already appreciated. Namely, if the black hole is an anti-de Sitter or a de Sitter black hole, it is known that the entropy can be written in terms of a so-called Cardi-Verlinde formula. So this is the equation for the de Sitter black hole. So here you have the energy of the black hole, and the EC is the Casimir energy. And this Cardi-Verlinde formula has precisely the right state count to comply with a conformal field theory in any dimension. So let's see what we can learn about this argument. In order to be able to describe black holes in ADS space or de Sitter space, we modify the line element a little bit, so we include a cosmological constant in our setup. So here it's the corresponding simple black hole solution embedded in a theory which contains a non-trivial cosmological constant. Then we want to apply our RG improvement tech. Not yet. Okay. First, the classical structure of the solution. So once we have a negative cosmological constant, there's actually a black hole horizon, a single black hole horizon of this solution. And for vanishing cosmological constant, this agrees with the Schwarzschild black hole. If the cosmological constant is positive, there are actually two cases that have to be distinguished. If the mass is lighter than this mass bound up here, there are two horizons. There is a black hole horizon and a cosmological horizon. And if the mass of the black hole exceeds this bound, we actually have a naked singularity. Then we can also compute the horizon temperature by taking the derivative of this function f with respect to R and evaluating at the horizon. This is the classical picture. So let's think about how we could RG improve the space-time. And what we want to first have is this identification of our scale k with some physical quantities. So there have been criteria put forward which this identification should satisfy. So first, it should be invariant under coordinate transformations. It should respect the symmetries of our solution. And in some sense, it should give a reasonable asymptotic behavior. A proposal that was already advocated in the initial paper is to identify this k with the inverse of the radial distance. So here, you integrate geodesics along the radial distance. And this result will naturally lead to something that is invariant under coordinate transformations. And since this equation only depends on the radial coordinate, it also respects all the symmetries of the solutions. Then you can take the scheme and you compute the short distance expansion of this guy. And then you find that high momenta are actually related with short distances. So this is also intuitively something that we want to see. Here I've only presented the leading term, but it turns out that the full function k of r can be easily obtained numerically. So now to the RG improvement. So we start from the classical line element. So here, these are the infrared values of our coupling constants. And in step one, we promote these guys to be actually scale invariant, depend on the RG scale k. We are interested in short distance physics for demonstration. So once we approach the non-Gaussian fixed point, this guy have very specific scaling behavior. So Newton's constant vanishes asymptotically at high energies. This is given here. And the cosmological constant will actually flow as k squared. And then we substitute the scaling relations into our line element. This is shown here. And in the next step, we replace our scale k squared by the cutoff identification. And then there's something very surprising happening. So here, it's the classical line element that we had before. And here's the line element that we obtain by the RG improvement at the non-Gaussian fixed point. And if you compare these two line elements, you actually see that they are of the same form. So there are some numerical factors appearing here and here, but otherwise, the structure didn't change. So what we conclude from this is that first, it was essential to include the effect of the cosmological constant in this computation. So you see that this equivalence only works if you take the cosmological constant into account. Then you observe that the RG improved line element is actually a Schwarzschild de Sitter black hole. And as a consequence, in this case, at the non-Gaussian fixed point, the horizon entropy will fulfill the classical Cardi-Wallinde formula. Then you can also compute the entropy of this black hole configuration at high energies. And you can actually derive also derived this entropy formula from the state counting property of gamma k. So this is given here, and it's governed by a universal quantity G star lambda star. Mm-hmm. Perfect. We can go on and look at the temperature that occurs for this Ag improved black holes. And here's the comparison. So temperature on this axis, mass divided by Planck mass on the x-axis. And the green line is the classical computation. The red line is the previous Ag improvement done by Bonanno and Reuter, which didn't take the cosmological constant into account. And the blue line is actually the temperature curve once we include the effect of a non-trivial cosmological constant. What we see is that for massive black holes with large masses, much bigger than the Planck scale, all three curves lie on top of each other, and effects only occur if we approach essentially masses of the size of the Planck mass. What is important, so in this previous computation down here, you see that the temperature goes to zero at finite mass. So previously it was thought that the theory will form black hole remnants, so black holes don't evaporate completely. So this picture changes once you take the cosmological constant into account. So you have this increase of temperature and the black hole will evaporate completely. Then you can play with embedding the black hole in different classical spacetimes. So one with a negative cosmological constant, one with zero cosmological constant, or positive cosmological constant. And then you see that actually this UV evaporation process is universal. So it the infrared value of the cosmological constant influences this, doesn't influence this behavior. So this guy is completely determined by properties of the non-Gaussian fixed point. So maybe if I have 5 more minutes, let's look at the relation between asymptotic safety and Horawa-Lifshitz gravity, because from that we learned also a very important lesson quite recently. So the idea of Horawa-Lifshitz is that you want to have a perturbatively randomizable quantum theory of gravity. And at the beginning of the slide, we learned that this doesn't work if you insist on metric degrees of freedom and diffeomorphism invariance. So the idea to get this is actually to relax the symmetry requirements of your theory. So you go to a weaker symmetry group. That means that at very high energies, your theory will violate Lorentz invariance. Also for this theory, you can write down or construct the effective average action, and you see that the flow equation that is obeyed by this has exactly the same form as we know from standard gravity. Then there's a question how this flow equation is actually related to the one before. And it turns out that you can embed the metric gravity construction into the bigger theory space of Horawa-Lifshitz gravity. So the idea is that Horawa-Lifshitz has a smaller symmetry group. That means I can write down more interaction monomials. This is in the blue space. And if you go to diffeomorphism invariant interactions, then these form a subspace of this bigger theory space, which is embedded up here. You can then use the flow equation to actually compute Ag flows, including this anisotropy parameter. And what we recently discovered is that also Horawa-Lifshitz gravity has a Gaussian fixed point. So at this Gaussian fixed point down here, the theory is Einstein-Hilbert without a cosmological constant. So in particular, this anisotropy parameter is given by lambda. And this is exactly one at this point. One can then envision a UV completion, which is anisotropic, and an RG flow crossing over to this Gaussian fixed point. So at that point, you will enjoy the properties of general relativity to very good accuracy. We played this game. So here are two example RG trajectories, which show the running of G and lambda. And here it's the anisotropy. And you see what happens if you start fine-tuning lambda to smaller and smaller infrared values. Then there's a plateau developing in small lambda, saying that this is very close to one for a very for many, many orders of magnitudes in scale space. So if we have the scenario that the Gaussian fixed point governs the infrared behavior of Horava-Lifshitz theory, then the fine-tuning problem that we have with the cosmological constant will also ensure that the anisotropy parameter is very small and compatible with experimental bounds. So this brings me to the three takeaway messages of this talk. So the first contains the fundamental perspectives of asymptotic safety. So we have strong evidence that this fixed point really exists. And we have seen that this is really connected to a regime where classical general relativity is valid in the infrared. We have some preliminary results on black holes in the theory. So we have checked microscopic black holes actually turn out to be Schwarzschild de Sitter. And the entropy will be compatible with a conformal field theory. The third and maybe most important lesson that we learned in this last year is an answer on the question why general relativity is actually so successful. And the idea is that GR actually emerges as a crossover phenomenon. So we have a UV completion that might be asymptotic safety or Horava-Lifshitz gravity. But if we flow to the Gaussian fixed point in the infrared, the flow will actually forget where it comes from and develop something that looks like GR to very high accuracy. I should also say that there will be a lot more on asymptotic safety in the parallel sessions. So here's the outline of talks that will be presented, and I'm definitely looking forward to these talks. Thank you.
So thanks for a nice summary. I'd like to understand this issue of fine-tuning. Is it a fair statement that, okay, so you find that there is a UV fixed point, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to get to the IR regime where basically you have classical GR, you got to do a fine-tuning, one part in 10 to the 70, right, to stay on that particular trajectory.
Yes.
And then if you go into very deep infrared, presumably cosmological distance is something else happens, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, we don't know what happens at these large cosmological distances.
Okay, and this is a fair statement also for as you increase operators, let's say you take a R squared, R to the fourth order, it's pretty much robust, the fine-tuning. It always stays of the of the same order.
You can phrase it that we don't have a dynamical solution to the cosmological constant problem.
Right.
It's like you have to measure the mass of the electron, and this is a relevant parameter and that you have to put into your theory.
Right. Okay, so I just wanted to understand. What happens if you, for example, go to three dimensions, right? Again, you have a dimension for G Newton.
Yes.
Right, and you got a lambda. So did you try, I mean, of course, in 3D, you say like, okay, it's perturbatively non-normalizable, but it's topological, whatever. So suppose you're just an RG person and do what you do.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find also a UV fixed point in 3D? And again, you have to do a fine-tuning in that case?
In this case, we have never constructed the phase space diagram, but what has been shown is that you can analytically continue the fixed point in 2 plus epsilon dimensions
okay.
to the four-dimensional fixed point through this method. So you can derive beta functions which are continuous in the dimension. And for 2 plus epsilon, you get the old perturbative results. And for epsilon equals to 2, you get this fixed point.
I mean, the 3D is interesting because, you see, in that case, you can really use Cardi mm-hmm. as opposed to Verlinde Cardi.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's an interesting mm-hmm. toy example
mm-hmm.
For you. Anyway.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks.
In the application to black holes, right, mm-hmm. And also cosmology, but say black holes in here, I mean, the key element is this method in which one just takes the constant G and lambda and yeah. replaces them by G of K, lambda of K,
mm-hmm.
And then in the solution tries to find out what, you know, the analog of K, basically, how should it. So there is some arbitrariness. So why, I mean, this is some kind of a scheme that one is just giving. So why would one trust these results at in the ultraviolet or something like that? I mean, where, for example, you yourself find that the spectral dimension is only 2 and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So if I just do this blind substitution and I get a solution, which is a continuous four-dimensional solution, why would I trust it? And secondly, in the detailed procedure, when you actually do these substitutions, right?
I mean, yes.
You found something that was kind of, you motivated what K should go to this distance that you mm-hmm. integrated. But I could find something else. I could take some curvature scalar, I could take some, you know, a combination yep. of the curvature scalar and mm-hmm. this, and then it would be complicated, a function of lambda and the mass mm-hmm. of the black hole and such things. And then I might get completely quite different results. So these are my two questions.
Okay, let's go for question two first. There are some properties that single out exactly this RG improvement scheme. So people have tried different identifications, like, for example, with the horizon area or with curvature scales, but this seems to be the only scheme that is self-consistent. So you can derive this RG improved solution, and then you could play the same game with this solution you have, and this is a fixed point in the space of these RG improvements. This is not true for all the other schemes that has been done before. So in this sense, the prescription that we applied here is singled out. On the other hand, concerning the method, you would definitely want to back this up by more sophisticated computations. But this is, I think, the level things are at the moment.
For small black holes, you found a drastic difference in the behavior depending on whether you included the cosmological constant or mm-hmm. not. Is there any reason to expect that there won't be an equally drastic change when you include higher order terms in the action? I mean, your UV surface has more than 2 degrees of freedom, right?
Mm-hmm.
So why should I believe this? Should I expect that next year you'll come and tell me, well, we included the R squared term and the temperature and there are remnants again?
Well, for R squared, I can tell you it doesn't influence the equations of motion. So the contribution to the equations of motion is proportional to D minus 4, so you will never see such a contribution in four dimensions. But I think the structure of the cosmological constant and the things of higher derivative terms are distinguished in the way things in the K dependence on how these dimension full quantities actually run. So if you do an R squared term, that will run logarithmically, so it has no chance to compete with this power law running that essentially you recreated the black hole singularity.
I'm a bit confused by the your expectation about the full theory. I mean, what is it? Somehow you say there is some indication that there is this fixed point because mm-hmm. I compute with 2 terms, with 3 terms, 5 terms, with 20 terms. So now I start believing. Do you expect that there is a actual theory at the fixed point, which is, and what would you expect? You expect it's a non-local action? Is a local action? It has an even number. What is your? Because somehow it's in a. We are in a situation in which you cannot go forever like that. At some point, you cannot, after 20, go to 30.
Oh, we can do infinite.
No, you cannot. I mean, so
yes, we can.
Because you're going to live for a finite amount of time.
Yes. Okay, I can also do momentum dependencies, which technically will be infinite. So there will be more talks on how to do infinite number of coupling constants this afternoon.
So,
but the essence of the question is, I think, yes, there will be a definite action that you can associate with this fixed point.
You think it will be non-local?
That I don't know.
That you know for sure, this action is necessarily going to be contain an infinite number of terms that, you know, in fact, an infinite series of infinite numbers of terms, the f of r squared. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's absolutely going to be infinite, and you have to fix all these infinite coefficients there. It's utterly, fundamentally non-local.
So we can discuss what these coefficients mean, but maybe. In the best of all worlds, you would say the action is very simple in the end, and the small coefficients that appear with the higher derivative terms are actually artifacts that you do an approximation in your computation.
But you still have to do the job.
There's a non-trivial chance that this actually happens.
But I think what Carlo is saying is that even if, let's say, you get evidence for that, you still have to do the job to find a principle that is going to fix this infinite number of small terms,
yes.
and you know, which is essentially what the mm-hmm. quest for quantum gravity is mm-hmm. that, you know.
Yes. Horava-Lifschitz wouldn't care for a non-Gaussian fixed point.
Do you have an ultraviolet non-Gaussian fixed point in Horava-Lifschitz?
We see the imprint of our asymptotic safety fixed point in Horava-Lifschitz. What we haven't checked is that the Gaussian fixed point postulated by Horava has the correct properties for the theory being renormalizable. So this is outside the approximation that we presently can do.
Yes, coming back to the question of Carlo and Laurent, if I remember correctly, the fixed point effective average action and the bare action may differ by one loop determinant.
Yes.
So could it be that all the non-locality and all this mess that you see is due to this one loop determinant, and that you have a nice, simple fixed point action there? A better question is, do you have evidence for this conjecture?
I think nobody has looked into this precise question.
Yeah, there's no reason to believe that gravity is going to be one loop exact. I mean, you know, we know theories which are one loop exact, n equal for supersymmetric or things like that, but if you don't have any symmetry principle, you're going to get contributions to all loops all the time.
Mm-hmm. If there is time, I don't want to. So maybe sharpen the question. Suppose for a moment you believed in loop quantum gravity. Suppose for a moment it was good. It was the correct theory. So there was some discreteness at the Planck scale. So some non-locality from your point of view of the Planck scale. So from the point of view of local field theory, this would be an infinite number of terms on a local theory. my question, which I never somehow got the point to, is that if that was the case physically, this approach, what would it see? Would it see the same thing somehow approaching the theory, or would it be incompatible with it? I've never understood this.
With discreteness?
So suppose the reality of the world is that there is a Planck scale finiteness and a non-locality down there. So in your terms, an actual true finite action which is non-local. Would you sort of recognize it as a fixed point from this perspective, or you would say, no, this doesn't is a possibility of having quantum gravity which is completely alternative to that one?
Well, in a sense, the fixed point will turn out whatever it will be. It's a prediction by, or it appears as a computational result.
The assumption of a fixed point is that there is scaling at high energy. And if there is a discrete structure, there is no scaling at high energy. I think they are distinct. I think so. I've always, if they're not alternative, then well, either you have scaling of some kind at high energy or you don't have scaling.
Before thanking Frank again, don't leave right after thanking him, because we'll have some more comments and some more music coming up. But now we can thank Frank again for the talk.